podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
If he kicks this, he can shave whichever part of his body he wants.
Welcome to this week's Attacking Scrum podcast. Delighted to say, Steph Thomas is with us once again. Hi, Steph. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Great to have you back on the show. And as always, having a well-read journalist like yourself makes my job a bit easier on nights like this where we have big Welsh rugby politics stories to get stuck into. So we're going to be having a look at that in this episode of the show, of course, referring to the vote that the results have been declared of today, with a view to the independent chairman proposition that the WRU clubs have voted on. So we're no doubt going to get stuck into that. No shortage of opinion on social media around that one. We will also have a look back at some of the URC action from this weekend, and we'll look forward to the start of the Autumn Internationals, or the Autumn Nations Cup, as we're now calling it, next weekend, as Wales take on New Zealand. But I suppose, Steph, the only place to start really is with the rugby politics, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say so. So, as your listeners probably already know, it was WAU AGM today, and 65.6% of the clubs voted in favour of bringing in an independent chair. Now, in the vast majority of businesses that are, organisations which are run democratically, that would be enough to, that's a vast majority, isn't it? You'd have thought that would come through, but the constitution of the Welsh Rugby Union is very archaic. It's not really fit for purpose, I would argue, and they need 75% of the vote. So obviously, the majority of clubs voted, but the minority have voted against. You could argue are holding back Welsh rugby. Obviously, the independent chair would have been somebody not elected by the club, so that would have then meant that Rob Butcher could, or whoever the chairman is, could concentrate more on the community game, and then you finally appoint somebody who is fit for purpose to run a £90 million business. They said, I was going to use the term turkeys voting for Christmas, yeah, but the majority of turkeys did vote for Christmas. That's the point. A lot of clubs, maybe we don't give them enough credit. A lot of people are really switched on and in the community game, and they want to see and they understand that if you get the professional game right, then the term I like to use is it would shit cash back down onto the community game. But unfortunately, you've got a minority who are dinosaurs, who are all about self-preservation, all about self-interest, and would, before voting for serious issues, would think about how does this affect my free ticket to Dublin and whatnot. And I could name, not go into, but I could give you about 10 examples of that, which are based on fact. But this was a good opportunity to really modernise the Welsh Rugby Union. It would have been a significant step forward in these trying times post-COVID. But unfortunately, the minority voted against it. And I fear that the result of this vote will be pretty damaging, really, for the game in Wales, not just at professional level, but the community game as well.
Yeah, and I think this is the thing, right, is, yes, the two things need each other, but they need each other in very, very different ways. We're not living in the era where, I know obviously every player has to start somewhere, and yes, they may well be attached to a club, but really, we're living in an era now where the vast majority of players are provided through academies. So yes, they may well go and play for their local club. That may be where they pick it up, and it is hugely important. But we're not referring back to the days where you would have someone, Cafilli, for example, who, and I've just plucked that out of thin air, who would then, you know, go on to play for Wales while still playing for them. You know, that's not the way that, that international rugby works now. That's not the way that, that professional rugby works. The community game is hugely important. And it is, because, you know, it's, as well as being an elite sport, this is a, you know, it's a hobby for many people. It's a centre of community. And that's, you know, that very essence, the community game, it's a hugely important thing. But to have the say of, as you said, you know, a near £100 million business decided by someone that doesn't necessarily have the experience in that is still just baffling. And it throws it back to the amateur era.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think amateur is the key word, really, isn't it? I think, as you said, the community game is vitally important. You know, the rugby or any sport isn't just about the professional game. It's about, you know, people's social lives, people's health, people's enjoyment. They, you know, most players don't join clubs to be professional players. They just play in there for enjoyment, and it's a centre of their communities in many ways. However, there isn't that much of a link. I'll get shot down for this, but there really isn't that much of a link between community rugby and professional rugby. There isn't, because these players get picked up at a very young age. The vast majority, in fact, all the development is really done at in the academies. You know, people shoot the academies down, but this is professional sport we're talking about now. All the fitness, all the S&C, all the skills, you know, getting ready for professional rugby. And I think the school system is probably also very, maybe is the one area that's really underutilized when it comes to producing, you know, professional players of the future. Whereas, so the community game is very important, but in terms of its link to the professional game, it's very minimal, really, isn't it? Which means it's, you know, it makes it absolutely absurd that, you know, you've got the community game running, calling the shots. You know, you've got people on, I've said this on the podcast before, you know, in the professional rugby board, you've got people on there, you know, people like David Buttress, you know, founded Just Eat, one of the most successful entrepreneurs in Wales, if not the UK. You've got people like that. You had Amanda Blanc, chief executive of Aviva, and these people, hugely qualified, hugely respected, know how to make money, know how to run businesses, get the best out of businesses. You know, number of occasions their recommendations would get blocked by the main WIU board, which has a community club majority. And that's wrong. You know, that is archaic. I say moral in many ways. And, you know, voting against the independent chair, if you'd had an independent chair, that would have been a big step in the right direction. And as I said, you get the professional game right, there's more money for the community game. But unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of people in Wales who aren't really switched on to that fact. So, yeah, I think it's a hugely damaging decision by the minority.
And this is it. In order to, you know, those community clubs, you're never going to have the... And again, I can't stress this enough. This is not having a go at individual clubs at all. But the opportunity for a community club to make... you know, to make enough money for it to sustain itself in the, you know, in these kind of trying times, is nigh on impossible. So they need the union to flourish financially. So it needs to be run like a business. So it needs to have more money that can then be, you know, that the chunk for the community game can then be distributed into it. And but as you said, they're separate things.
Yeah, they're absolutely separate things. But what gets me is that the majority of community clubs,
yeah,
probably agree with you, as this vote showed. So there's loads of great people in the community game. You know, they're vital, they're as important as the pro game, but it only, you know, it's the constitution, isn't it? You know, 65% is a landslide. It is, isn't it? That is an absolute landslide. Yet the fact that there's only a small percentage and it stops something going through, I mean, to have to meet 75, but you're never going to get anything done. Yeah. There's never going to be any change. It's a disgrace, really. And I think they need to have a vote on the constitution, because it needs to change. Because the game in Wales is in a very precarious position, and you know, success at international level isn't going to prop it up for much longer. If we get success, so yeah, I think we've said this before, but yeah. Welsh rugby is in a pretty bad state, and it's hard to see how we can improve in the near future.
And you say, yeah, I mean, that's the interesting point, is you say that there's a need for a vote on the constitution. Well, if there was, that vote is presumably again thrown out to, you know, is thrown out to all of the clubs and would require a 75% majority. So in many respects, you could have, like, it's purely academic.
You could have like 73% voting in favour. You know, it's ludicrous. It's an embarrassment. You know, but there are a lot of issues of the Welsh rugby. There are a lot of areas of the Welsh rugby union which are rooted in the past. You know, you compare it to the FAW, and you know, there was a time not so long ago where they were an absolute shambles, a laughing stock, but they took note, and the way they've modernised the game and their attitude towards everything is so modern. You know, that they're in touch with younger people, a young generation. But, you know, there really is, like, you know, just the Welsh Rugby Union in general, it really needs to modernise, not just in terms of this and the constitution, but in this general outlook of everything. I think there needs to be, a significant improvement. And you know, you look at the governance of the game and the way it's governed. That, you know, you take this to any other sport or any other professional organisation, and you explain the way the Welsh Rugby Union or Welsh Rugby is run, and you just get people scratching their heads. Yeah. Like it doesn't, you know, it's just really disappointing. And as I said, you know, as it stands, you know, people like to shout at journalists for being negative, but I only deal in facts. And the fact is, it's very, very difficult to see how Welsh rugby can pull itself out of the current hole it finds itself in.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one thing I would say, Steph, and this is, you know, scant consolation, really, is that whole thing about self-interest, we've touched on this before, this is across the whole of rugby as a whole. You know, I think that if you look back, whatever we've been, kind of 2.5 years since COVID plunged or accelerated the finances of the game into utter chaos, we said a number of times, this is an opportunity to reform the way the professional game is played, you know, whether it's global calendar, whether it's too much rugby, whatever it might be. And 2.5 years down the line, you find, you know, two clubs in the English Premiership have gone pop. The collective debt that there is there as well suggests that there could be other clubs that follow suit, or certainly will be fighting very hard to make sure they don't follow suit. You know, this is not limited to Welsh rugby, but that until you get past that self-interest, there are going to be casualties, and there are going to be, there is a real danger, and I don't think I'm being overly dramatic when I say this, there is a real danger that the entire game runs out of money. When you look at the fact that, you know, attendances generally are dwindling, the international game is, you know, is struggling to fully capitalise on where it should be. The club game across, you know, with the exception of France, perhaps, you know, kind of across the board is struggling to drum up that interest. And you've got lawsuits looming around concussion with a number of major unions and with World Rugby. And if compensation has to be paid to these players, then there is a real chance that the whole game could go bankrupt. I don't think I'm being overly dramatic by saying that.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, it's in evidence at the moment, isn't it? You know, we look at the situation in England. You know, a lot of clubs have been living beyond their means. You know, two have, you know, gone into administration, and you know, it's going to be a long, long road back for them if they ever get back. And just the game in general as well. I mean, rugby union has, you know, rugby has as a sport has an overinflated ego. Mm. It thinks that it's bigger than what it is. But the fact of the matter is, rugby is a niche sport. It's hugely popular in some nations, New Zealand, South Africa, Wales. Although it's not as popular in Wales as people think, if you've got any overseas listeners. Football is king here by far. But, you know, rugby, you know, you look at look at Super 12 as an example. Well, not Super 12, but Super Rugby. But you look at when it was Super 12, that was better than Test rugby. Mm. It was that good. You had the best of South Africa, best of New Zealand, best of Australia. Then suddenly they started to think to themselves, And this is why I'm against the North Whalian region, right? Australians are like, oh yeah, no, let's go into Perth, you know, let's go into Western Australia where hardly anyone plays union, it's all Aussie rules and rugby league. That didn't work, you know, they brought them in and the Kings came in South Africa and they just expanded too much. You know, if you want to expand, you have to do it very slowly. But they started expanding and then, you know, you get all these ideas about bringing American teams in and all that. And, you know, rugby takes these, they make these big decisions. They see pound signs or dollar signs and they take it without thinking about the long-term consequences of things. Short-term is good. Then long-term, they don't realise that they could actually lose money because rugby has just been diluted as a product. It's not the sport it was. There's too many international fixtures. They make a lot of money from Test rugby, but it's not. Look at the attendances. I'm got them in front of me now, but attendances were going down in autumn internationals for years. You know, even haven't sold out the All Black game yet.
I was going to say, I had a text message this morning saying tickets still available.
Last week, the ex-WU chief executive, and I told him that, and he couldn't believe me. He's like, are you sure? You know, he said to me, even you know, when Wales were absolutely abysmal, they'd sell that game out. And I remember growing up, you know, that when Wales played Australia, South Africa, it was a special event. It's not really anymore. And I just think it's, you know, there's been too much Test rugby. And that's a big problem. Less is more, I think. I think there's more potential for growth long-term in the club game. You know, but again, I mean, you know, the Heineken Cup, the old Heineken Cup, you know, that's been diluted. It made an absolute mess for the European Cup. It's not the competition it was. It's just a dog's dinner. It's not even that important anymore. So I just think, you know, there's a lot of short-term thinking in rugby, not long-term thinking. And, you know, you look at I don't blame the players whatsoever. No, I'm really sorry for the players. But you got the whole situation with wages. They're far too high. Again, nothing against the players. Feel really sorry for them. But England are doing the right thing at the moment. They have to aggressively cut down player wages. It has to happen in Wales as well.
Yeah.
It just has to happen, right? And you know, we've just been spending beyond our means, apart from the top 14, obviously, and to a lesser extent the Japanese league. So there's that, and then you know the whole issue with concussion. You know, it really, really annoys me. You know, I won't name him. I saw an absolutely idiotic statement on Facebook yesterday by a former Welsh captain, right? And you know, it was the Brodie Retallick red card, which,
yeah,
you know, if you don't think that's a red card, then you have no knowledge of the laws of rugby union. And, you know, he said, you know, the game's gone soft. Are you destroying our great game? And I was thinking to myself, actually, no, they're trying to save the great game of rugby union, because they're not just trying to save the health of the players and their future lives after rugby, because they're trying to save the game as well. Because if I had a child, I haven't got any children, I wouldn't want to play rugby, because the evidence, there's going to be more and more people coming out with neurological conditions, brain injuries, dementias, you know, all that sort of thing, which is going to greatly impact their lives. And rugby says it's trying to solve it, but look at the decisions in the URC. That ridiculous hit by that Munster player on, I forget who, you know, who he tackled straight to the face. It was a few weeks back, that Glasgow player to I think it was Josh Adams, and then, you know, last week, you know, that disgusting, absolute disgraceful decision by that referee in the Scarlets game when Tom Price's second row was drilled into the ground head first. The referee has brought the game to disrepute. He's got no, you know, evidently he does not value the safety of his players highly as much as he should. That's a clear red card. And, you know, I just think any contact to the face, direct shoulder to the head, should be a red card. You know, I have no idea how the Scottish player, I forget who it was, sorry, yesterday in the Australia game, didn't have a red card. That was a bullshit explanation by Luke Pearce, I'm afraid. You know, bicep hit him, so not a red card, but if his shoulder had, it would have been a red card.
It's nonsense.
So my point is, I'm going off on tangent, but rugby's got so many issues, it's going to it's going to lose a lot of money over concussion. It's going to lose a lot of future players. And the game as a whole is at a real crossroads. And I think people don't really realise that the future of the game is actually at stake over the next few years. And, you know, I'm not really that confident that, you know, rugby will be salvaged, because I haven't really got confidence in the people running the game on a global scale.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And a lot of those things are actually linked, I would argue, Steph. You know, if you made the game safer, then for a start, you would have more confidence in people playing it at a grassroots level, with younger people playing it and increasing the participation levels, which, you know, which obviously helps, as we said, it can help feed academies, or it can just help the interest in the overall game. You know, if someone's going to the rugby club, gets into the sport and ends up going to watch internationals and going to watch the club team, great, that's fantastic. Mm. The safety does part of that. Likewise, if you couple it with playing less games, so not so much, not even just diluting the product, but diluting the physical burden that's required on the players, you'd need smaller squads, because there would be less injuries. You wouldn't be flogging these players to death, and as a result, you wouldn't be needing to spend as much on squads collectively. And there is a chance that you might just find a sustainable financial model within rugby. But as you've said, it's just been kind of petrol on the fire every single time. It's right, more test rugby. Players are knackered. Quite rightly, they expect to be remunerated properly for that. Mm. You know, in a game that's really high risk, and they're expected to take their body to the limits.
They're putting their future well-being at risk.
Absolutely.
Look at Steve Thompson, yeah. Alex Popper, Michael Lippmann. You know, there are many more. Adam Hughes, you know, the Sean Tane Happy. I mean, the stories, you know, that these guys, you know, when you listen to the stories of these guys, you know, like the Steve Thompson documentary the other week, you know, I've interviewed a few myself, and it's heartbreaking. And yeah, I, as I said, I wouldn't be that confident, comfortable allowing my child, if I had any, to play rugby at the moment. And the game's under threat. I think that much is clear.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Are there anything, Steph, that you think, you know, whether it's long term or short term, that the governance, you know, at a world level should be looking at? What are the main priorities that World Rugby and whoever the power brokers are should be looking at?
I think I just listed a few off. I think concussion needs to be number one on the list, player safety, for the reasons I just stated, for the players and, you know, for the, you know, to persuade future players to play the game. I think they need to look at a more sort of long-term vision for the international game. There's too much test rugby. I think that needs to be sorted out. Obviously, I still want to grow the game, but, you know, it's you need to do it slowly. You need to get people involved at an amateur level first in developing nations, rather than just sort of going all straight in and giving them professional status. So there's that. There's just so many things. I think the laws need looking at in many aspects. So there's a lot, really. But the problem is I'm just not really sure that the right people are running the game. I think there's a lot of self-interest, you know, and that's the issue. The first thought that comes into anyone's mind is it's all about self-preservation. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest issue I've got. And also, I'd like to say, like, going back to the concussion, you know, a lot of former internationals, you know, they say, oh, the game's gone soft, that's not a red card, with relation to Brodie Retallick. They've got a responsibility as well, you know, because people...
They've got a platform, right?
Yeah, listen to these people, because they were great players, and they need to educate themselves a little bit on the dangers of head injuries. You know, it's not, I was talking to a doctor recently, and he was saying it's not necessarily the huge concussions which knock you out. Obviously, they're hugely dangerous, because with them, they're obvious. You know, you can, you know, you know they're knocked out, you take them off. It's the successive sub-concussions. That was the term, sub-concussions, from head knocks, from consistent head knocks. The ones that aren't obvious, but just over time. So that's my main, you know, the issue I would like to sort of see solved. And I just think rugby, I said this in the podcast before as well, on this podcast, that rugby is stuck in, it's stuck between trying to appease those dinosaurs who, you know, think the game's going to soft down the player's safety point of view. And I just, you know, I go back to the Scotland game. I think Luke Pearce is a tremendous referee. I think he's one of the best in the world. Could argue he's the best, but I just thought that was a bullshit explanation. And sorry, I forget what Scott's player was. You know, he clears it out direct to the head, coming from a distance. And he said, because it was his bicep, it's a lower degree of danger. And it therefore, it's the yellow card, whereas the shoulder would have been red. That's nonsense. That's nonsensical.
They need
to say anything to the head with force is a red card. End of discussion.
There is too much mitigation, too many grey areas. And I think about 18 months, 2 years ago, we had a position where, although it would cause a stir on social media and whatever, we were kind of in that position. If there was contact to the head, it was gone. And if we'd have carried on that same route, by now, that would have died down and people would have just accepted it and wouldn't know by now. This mitigation bullshit has created this halfway house, and that is just, you know, that's not good enough when you're looking at protecting players' lives. And if it makes old internationals disgruntled or armchair fans or whatever, I think that first and foremost you've got to make sure that this game is safe for people to play, and it will change players and coaching habits if you stick with that hard line view.
The responsibility of the players as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like, the players know, and coaches, they know that you can't hit somebody direct on the head. So I know where rugby's played 100 miles an hour and mistakes happen, but with a retarded one, he knew what he was doing. There's no point defending it. The guy is jackled. He's in a low position. He's come in from distance at force and smashed him in the head. Well, he knows what he's doing. You know, it's not, he's not a dirty player. Well, you know,
whether he is or isn't, is it irrelevant?
It's a red card offence. And, you know, it's the same all the time. Oh, he's not a dirty player and stuff. Well, it's irrelevant. He knows what he's doing. He's done that. You know, therefore it's a red card. And, you know, there's so many instances. I mean, I remember it was in the Sharks Ospreys game. The Stormers Ospreys game recently. And I think it was Ethan Roots late on, shoulder direct to the head, and nothing, not even sighted. You know, I haven't got any words for it. I just think this is the number one priority for me.
And we'll finish on this just before we go to the break, but you think how often they're going to the sodding TMO for the most minimal of fractional forward passes or perhaps a minor knock on three phases before. And that stuff kills the game from an entertainment point of view. TMO is there, and their primary concern should be around, yes, the howling decisions. And, you know, grounding, yeah, of course, that's fine. You've got to check these things. That's what it's always been there for. But serious foul play is the most important reason why it's there. You know, if Wales lose to New Zealand because of a forward pass, right, okay, that's bad, but that stuff has always been in the game. If a player gets hit to the head and nothing is done about it, then that's a completely different scenario. And I'm just, there's one of these every week, one of those every single week. You will be able to come on here and go, right, that was a disgrace, that should have been a red card. Why wasn't it? And I'm afraid it's just been allowed to happen for the last 6-12 months, and it's not good enough.
No, absolutely agree. But I think I've said enough on this subject. So
right, well, we better talk about some rugby at some point, Steph, as well, and we're going to do that in the second half of the show. But first, we're going to take a very quick break. Right, time then, Steph, to talk about some on-the-field action. I really wanted this episode of the show to be called 47 Reasons Why the Dragons Are Going to Win the League, such is the good mood that I was in. You can always rely on Welsh rugby politics to throw a curveball in and scupper that. But yeah, we're going to have a quick roundup of the URC action now. I'm going to start with the Dragons because obviously it pleased me. I said with Murph last week, you know, there was always the, if ever a side was capable of losing at home to the home to Zebre, it was the Dragons. They didn't do that. I thought they looked very convincing. I don't think you can read too much into this result because Zebre, you know, are not a particularly strong opposition, particularly away from home. But there was quite a lot, I thought, to be pleased about. The general skills looked a lot better, and the hunger seemed to be there from this Dragons outfit from, you know, from minute 1 to 80.
Yeah, well, they look like a happy camp, don't they? I think Dave Flanagan's doing an excellent job. Perhaps as a honeymoon period, I don't know. We'll see over time, but you know, we know that they haven't got a squad that can compete to win silver, maybe even make the playoffs. But as we've said, they've got enough good players. It's the strongest squad they've had for a long time to be competitive, and that's what they are. And it was more. It wasn't just the fact they won, because obviously Zebre are a banana skin, but they put them away. They put them to the sword. They played. They looked very confident. You know, they're offloading game, and just every player knows his role. Every player believes that he's a good player. You know, he wants to play for the coach. It's obviously a very good environment. I think Di Flanagan's a great bloke. I think he's a tremendous individual, and it's really good to see a young Welsh coach because you know there hasn't been enough for them, given an opportunity and really thrive. They're going to lose games. They're going to have a few hidings probably if they come up against Leinster and they've had injury crisis and all that sort of thing. But, you know, he is getting the best out of the squad he's got. You know, they should have beaten the Sharks as well, which would have been a tremendous result. They weren't that far away from Cardiff. You know, they beat the Ospreys deservedly. So I think they're a team that's on the up. I mean, there is a limit to how well they can do because of funding and the way the game is governed in this country. But I just think Flanagan is doing a fantastic job, and it's, you know, it's a very happy camp at the moment.
Yeah, you mentioned it being a happy camp. You also mentioned players believing that they're a good player. And I think there's arguably no bigger confidence player in that side than Sam Davis. And, you know, he was, and I said I felt sorry for him for huge chunks of the last two seasons because he was the only 10 at the club and, you know, was basically forced to play 80 minutes of every single game. And I think so much of that affected his confidence. Stuff like his goal kicking, he'd always been a very reliable goal kicker. And two seasons went past and he became very, very shaky. Looked really assured of himself. And I think that again, is testament to what Di Flanagan is doing, that, you know, he's getting the best out of players who, you know, who were looking a bit shot in the past couple of seasons, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Sam's a good example. I mean, he's a good player. You know, he turned down opportunities to go and play in England and France to chase his dream of a Welsh cap. That hasn't happened, but, you know, he's done well for the Dragons, but I think his form dipped because, you know, he was in a, you know, it wasn't a great environment under Dean Ryan, and obviously he was carrying the team effectively. Yeah. There was no one else. You know, obviously, Reid came through, but he's, you know, he's still learning the game. JJ Hanrahan's been an astute signing. He's no world beater. He's not going to set the world alight, but in a similar fashion to Stephen Myler at the Ospreys. You know, he's an experienced player, does the basics well, and it's taken pressure off Sam, hasn't it? It's not really competition. It's just sharing the load. And I think that's a smart acquisition. But look, I think Flanagan told me that he'd learnt a lot from Brad Moore in an interview a few months back. Brad used to say when he was at the Scarlets on the Crusaders, apparently, treat every day like you're in Disneyland. And I think Di is the sort of coach that focuses on a player's strength. There are players who are never going to be good at a certain aspect of the game, but Flanagan, you know, gives them confidence and that they play to their strengths. I just think they said the same when he was at the Scarlets. He's a tremendous man manager. Maybe he's not the greatest technical coach in the world, although he is a good coach, but what stands out is his man management and how he gets the best out of individuals. And I think that's, I think it's, you know, David Buttress deserves credit as well. I think he spotted, you know, a young coach, not a big name, gave him an opportunity, did his due diligence, and you know, he's doing a good job. So yeah, I think it's good to see at the moment because the Dragons have been the whipping boys for so long. It's you know, that I my other fans are turning, we used to turn out week in, week out, see them, you know, lose a home to like Zebre and have 50 points put on them. But finally, they're a competitive outfit. They're not going to win every game, but if you beat them at Rodney Parade, you're going to have to do it the hard way, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah, no, look, yeah, everyone knows my thoughts on that. I'm very much agreed with you. I think the interesting thing as well is, you know, obviously you've mentioned their funding, but the squad looks as, you know, a lot stronger than it has for over a decade, I would say. And I know that you're only ever a few injuries away from it, that becoming a problem, but players like Max Clark and Lonsdale, I think, have been, you know, have slotted in really, really nicely. Yeah. And you know, it didn't look like a squad that was shorn of its internationals. Whereas last season, we needed Will Rowlands in that side to even be competitive in a game.
I think like Lonsdale and Knott might be, and Max Clark, below international level, but they're, you know, they're sort of, they could play international rugby, but they're never going to be frontline international players. So when the internationals are away, that's a high quality sort of player to have in your international window squad, and they haven't had that before. In the past, it's a more balanced squad, isn't it? If you Absolutely. In contrast to the Scarlets, for example, which is a really badly balanced squad. You know, we'll get onto that later, but they've got you know, in the past there was a big, when you lost your frontline player, there was a huge dip between first choice and second choice. No, there isn't. There's hardly, you know, there's a couple of percent off, for example. And they've got some really good young talent coming through as well. So, as I said, you know, they're not going to be beating Leinster. Yeah, they're not going to be winning silverware, but at the very least, they can be competitive and take scalps. And I think more Stragglers fans would take that after, you know, 10 to 15 years in the doldrums.
Yeah, and as you said, I think particularly at Rodney Parade, it makes a big difference. And to have won 3 from 4 at home, and really should have put the Sharks away, I think. Yeah. And you know, that will be looked at as a missed opportunity. So, yeah, definitely some encouraging signs at home there. I want to talk about the Ospreys next, because that was you know, their problem seems to have been an inability to put sides away. I would say they seem to have this habit this season of not being able, you know, of kind of having won the physical battle, but not being able to put sides to the sword. What do you put that down to, Steph?
It's difficult. Coaching has to come into it. There's no point getting away from that. I think Toby Booth has been a good appointment. I think he's created a very good culture. I think he's an outstanding forwards coach. But, you know, he said himself, you know, that last season they had enough wins to make the playoffs, just not enough winning bonus points. Perhaps this is slightly unfair, but as a forwards coach, they're probably only going to play one way. You know, they got Richard Fussell as a backs coach, but at the moment, when you look at the Ospreys' strongest back line, you see Webb and Anscombe halfbacks, maybe Owen Watkin and George North centres, Michael Collins fullback, or Prothro, or Max Nagy's doing really well, and obviously got Cuthbert and on fire Keelan Giles, and Luke Morgan ain't bad either. That's a very good backline. That's one of the best backlines on paper in the URC. So why aren't they getting the best out of that back division is a big question to ask. You know, the Scarlets again slammed as the worst Welsh region, but ultimately they've won as many games as the Ospreys. The Ospreys are probably a better team than Scarlets. You know, the games have been tighter, and they haven't been blown away like the Scarlets. They are a better team, but you know, they've made progress in certain aspects of the performances. But ultimately, what matters is your results. And on paper, they should be beating the Dragons, for example. Obviously, you know, they did well to get that draw against the Stormers, and they got a pack that can compete with anyone, including a lot of South African teams. But and on paper they got the backs, but there is something missing, and it's hard to put your finger on it. But the coaches have got to find a way to fix that, because at the moment results aren't good enough. Because I've said it before, on paper they got a squad that should be looking to make the playoffs. If Connacht make the playoffs ahead of the Ospreys, it's simply not good enough. And there is something missing there. certainly.
I wonder
if you're enough at the moment.
You're right. I mean, you look at the first 15 or the first 23 is brilliant, and I would argue the squad depth in the pack is good. I think it's just certain key positions. I think that when you take Webb out at nine, you're then relying on a young a kind of young halfback combo.
Well, Reuben Morgan Williams played well.
He played very well. Yeah, he did.
Played really well.
He wasn't the issue, but I think that having that experience in the side can make a big difference. You know, in terms of closing games out, it's not about an individual performance.
When you play, you look at Stephen Mueller. You say that, and he's got huge experience. We're not playing any rugby with him there.
There's
no point beating around the bush. He does. He's a great goal kicker. He's got great control, great tactician, but there's zero attacking threat. He's not going to get his backs going. He hasn't got the peripheral vision to do that. You know, he's not Gareth Anscombe, is he? He's not, he's not Dan Bigger even. He's good at what he does, but, I was a bit disappointed they let Josh Thomas go to Newcastle. I thought he was a really good prospect. Jack Walsh, I think, is a good one. I think he's been impressive.
But they're
little parts of his game that aren't quite right. Like, he missed that penalty against the Lions, which he should have had. He does the hard things well and the easy things not as well. But I think he's got huge potential. But the Ospreys have got the cattle behind the scrum. But, it's just not coming together at the moment. And perhaps that's a tactical thing. I don't know. But there is something missing and it's hard to put your finger on it.
It is. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that as the season progresses. Scarlet's next, Steph. Pretty grim outing for them again, as you probably could have predicted against Leinster, when they're kind of shorn of their internationals. Did have this question in from David Collis, which says, do you think that Peel's going to last the season?
I think you have to be very naive to think that Dwayne Peel is the biggest issue at that club. I don't think he's an issue. I would stick with Dwayne Peel. I think he's inherited, and I'm not saying that he's naive, by the way, I'm just making a point, but he's inherited the squad. I think the Scarlets have been in decline since Wayne Pivak's final season. Brad Moore came in. A lot of Scarlet fans want him back. I don't think he's the answer. I think he's a good coach, but I don't think he's the answer at the moment. And I think that was damaging, him going back to New Zealand, because he's scoured the globe for Pivak's successor and he's gone within half an hour, basically. Delaney didn't work. Peel he'll be there for the long run, I think. But if you look at his backroom team, there's no experience there. There's no top end experience in comparison to other clubs, other top clubs. If you compare them to Leinster's backroom team, for example, because people look at the head coach, but they don't look at the whole coaching situation. I think the squad is very unbalanced. It's really unbalanced. They've got international players who aren't playing as well as they should. There's been mistakes in terms of recruitment, I think, as well. I think that much is obvious. And I think that I just think that Dwayne has been set up to fail at the moment. I think he's got huge potential as a coach. And this comes from me speaking to players who have been coached by him and other coaches. He's actually hugely respected. I think it would be a big mistake to get rid of Dwayne Peel. I think the Scarlets need a very experienced, perhaps, director of rugby.
Yeah.
I think that's what's needed to guide Peel. That's what should have happened from the start. He's just been, look at Glenn Delaney's last season. Right? They lost at home, 50-odd points to Sale, with a team stacked full of internationals. At least Dwayne's got the excuse of, he's got a huge injury list, for example.
Both the second row suspended as well.
No Welsh team can sign players at the moment. It's just ridiculous. You can't even plan, And, Delaney lost games like that. Brad Moore did as well. There was one embarrassing defeat up in Edinburgh. There were bad defeats there. People forget. Last season with Pivak was really bad. So this has been a gradual decline for a long time. So to get a head coach who is pretty inexperienced, albeit with a lot of potential, to come in, and then you say to him, oh, you sort all this out in a short space of time. He hasn't had one recruitment cycle yet, because majority of the squad are in long-term contracts and will be out of contract at the end of this season. And he'll have, you know, well, I wouldn't say he's going to have a chance to shape his squad, but at the moment he can't sign any players.
If he ever gets a budget, yeah.
That's a problem. But theoretically, he should. But I just think it's really unfair to expect one man to solve everything. I think the club have got to look at some of the decisions that have been made over the last few years. I think they got some decisions wrong in terms of coaching, and that's not Peel I'm on about, it's other coaches, in terms of recruitment and retention, in my opinion. I think they've let some players go that they perhaps shouldn't have. All subjective, of course, and you know they haven't got a crystal ball, I realise that. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I think it would have been great if Dwayne could have an experienced director of rugby or an experienced assistant coach to help guide him. And I just think they just need to write this season off and hopefully recruit really aggressively next season. Wield the axe. A lot of players need to go. A lot of experienced internationals need to go. There's no point, you know, beating around the bush. Some players are just not playing as well as they should. And it's very disappointing, you know, the way some senior internationals, you know, they did well in the first half out in Connacht and then they just imploded in the second half. You know, Dwayne's got a squad with only one top-class second row. Fire for feet as a blindside flanker. He's only got one top-class second row. They haven't replaced Jake Ball and he's been gone for 2 years. So, you know, there's a lot of issues there, but I think he needs to wield the axe. I think he needs to be ruthless, and I mean that absolutely ruthless in the summer. And I think he needs to be back to bring in the players he wants to bring in. I think they need to be ambitious. So I just think mistakes have been made. But I think those who believe that Peel is the problem, and it's, you know, it's coming from an informed point of view, those who believe that Peel is the problem are wrong. He's not the problem. There are problems at the club, but he's not one of them. He's part of the solution. So I just think he needs to be judged in the long run, not the short term.
Yeah, it's really interesting, but obviously things are not in a good position around there. I think some really interesting points there. I suppose the only thing you would say with regards to not just Peel but any head coach when you go through that losing spell, and I'm not saying that he is the problem, but there is going to be a degree of scrutiny, isn't there? I don't think he's going to be afforded that luxury of we're going to write this season off. I think he'll have to find a way with those players to grind out some results that just buy him that time and a summer of recruitment, as you and I know, recruitment isn't done in the summer, it's done now, and the teams don't know what their budgets
exactly
are. But yeah, in the short term, it's been a grisly start to the season. Just before we go on to talk about the internationals, Cardiff would have been hoping to continue their winning run. They weren't able to beat Edinburgh today. What have you made of their season as a whole, Steph?
It's been topsy-turvy, isn't it? I thought the best performance of a Welsh club this season was against the Stormers last weekend. Rhys Priestland was magnificent in that game and should wear the Welsh number 10 shirt against New Zealand, as far as I'm concerned. You know, they obviously came up against a good Edinburgh team. I think Edinburgh are a really underrated team. I think they're hugely underrated, very well coached team. Always got a strong pack. Never now play a really good brand of rugby as well. And I think, you know, they were without their internationals, it was a step too far. You know, as I've said, you know, there's still a lot of holes in the squad. You know, tighter prop, hooker, second row. I think Dai is working with he hasn't really got the cattle, I don't think. I think he's a really good coach. Mm. I think he's doing as well as he can, really. The Stormers game was an example of excellent coaching, excellent organisational skills as well. But obviously there was the issue with the egg gate in the pub. So there's probably has been some cultural issues, but I think that's probably galvanised him a bit. But again, he know, the problem is when you add COVID, and I'm not saying this was the right thing to do, but because players took pay cuts, they obviously had an extra year put onto their contracts. So Dai, you know, it's not like fans need to understand the ecosystem that these clubs operate in. In football, you have a transfer window. You know, there's loads of money, so a new manager can come in and change a squad in a matter of months, but in rugby, it could take up to 3 years. You know, no recruitment is better than bad recruitment. And I would question their recruitment down the years, but Dye hasn't been given a recruitment cycle, really. I mean, he's brought in a couple of players, yes, in the summer, but there's a lot of players in that squad that probably do. You know, I think he needs to be a bit ruthless, like Dwayne as well. So I think, you know, this summer could, you know, I think Dye needs to be given a couple of seasons, but if he gets a playing budget, big if that, obviously, I think he'd be able to really strengthen the squad next season and to shape it in the way he wants it shaped. Because he said, I've asked him on a number of occasions in press conferences about the lack of leadership, and he's been in total agreement. Mm. There's a lack of leadership at the club on and off the field. I think if more people were like Josh Turnbull, you know, they'd be winning more games, wouldn't they? And that's not to say that, you know, some players just aren't natural leaders. I think that's something that they need to solve, and I'm pretty confident that Dye will solve it, but obviously he needs a playing budget to do that, which he hasn't got yet.
No, exactly. Yeah, we'll all wait with bated breath to see if that happens this side of April. Lots that all ties it back to that sorry political state. Let's take a look ahead, though, Steph, to the start of, well, I say the start, the Autumn Internationals got underway yesterday, really, I suppose, on this, in the UK, kind of a bit of, again, just one of these weird rugby scheduling nuances that just detracts away from trying to create a spectacle around it, doesn't it? The fact that you've kind of got these staggered starts. I think it's, I understand there are scheduling issues, but it's just a bit weird having Scotland start and none of the other home nations, if you like, taking place on the same thing. It just putting a marketing hat on for a minute, it just makes those things a bit harder and it just becomes more fragmented. Again, you try and explain it to someone who's not a rugby fan, and it's not an easy thing to do. But that said, Wales get their campaign underway next week against, you know, I suppose the most stuttering New Zealand side in my lifetime. What chance do you give Wales of kind of breaking that hoodoo of many, many, many decades without a win against New Zealand?
I think they've got a chance. They got a better chance than in recent years, but I still think New Zealand are heavy favourites. Mm-hmm. I think New Zealand have... It's a very odd season, really, because you would class it as a failure, but they still won the Rugby Championship and the Blairstow Cup. They still won a test in South Africa against the world champions. And I think, you know, there's been flashes of brilliance. They're still a team that can put teams to the sword. You know, they still got all the skills. They're still a very ruthless team. They've still got great individual players. But what they don't have, there is a soft underbelly up front, which there wasn't in the same... 2011 World Cup, 2015 World Cup, in the sort of McCall Carter era. People under, even though they played pretty rugby, it was good in the eye, they still could play dirty. They had great fundamentals, they had a great platform. But their pack isn't as bad as that, but they're not as good as England up front, Ireland up front, France up front, South Africa up front. So when they get ahead of steam, they can still beat sides by 40 or 50 points. But I think the chance Wales have got is, When Wales played out in South Africa, they didn't play much rugby. They drew them into an arm wrestle. They went back to war and ball, and you know they should have won the first test. They won the second, competitive in the third, but stepped too far. If they can do that in Cardiff, if they can get under New Zealand's skin, they got to start well. And then they don't start well, do they? Because they just never have historically. Mm. And obviously, a lot of them are coming from the regions, and the things aren't great there. So it takes a bit of time to get up to speed of test rugby. I think Wales are going to frustrate them. I think they've got to make sure that New Zealand don't start well. And I think if you get to like 50 minutes and it's tight, Wales have got a chance. But my worry is that, you know, the Welsh defence isn't as strong as it was. And if New Zealand get up ahead of steam, they still only need two or three chances to score tries. Whereas Wales will butcher Wales will have five chances and probably score one of them. Whereas New Zealand have five and score four, if not five. But Wales do have the ability, I think, to get under their skin up front. Jason Ryan has really improved New Zealand up front, mind you. Ethan de Groot, one of the best scrummage and loosers in the world. So they've improved up front. But if Wales can drag them into an arm wrestle, if they can drag the game down to their level, like they did to the Springboks, you know, I think it'd be a mistake not to select Tommy Rethel, if I'm being honest. I was a bit surprised by Tipperick as captain. He's a good captain, but I'm not sure he's gone. Well, obviously,
well, he is now, size, yeah.
He's guaranteed his place, but I think there's an argument that Rethel should be starting. Maybe he'll play six. I'm not sure. But I think that Wales do have the forwards to cause New Zealand problems. But I just don't think, you know, they're not as strong as France, Ireland or England up front or South Africa. But they're strong enough to cause problems, but maybe not strong enough to really really win this game. I think losing Dan Biggar leaves a big leadership void. But I do think having Rhys Preston at 10 or Gareth Anscombe at 10, you know, make Wales a lot more dangerous offensively. The best performance by Welsh 10 this season isn't from Dan Biggar or Anscombe. It's Priestland against the Stormers the other week. And given Anscombe hasn't played much recently, I think Rhys Priestland's got to start, in my opinion. I think he should start.
So yeah, I think it's a massive call. That
could
one,
be
Steph.
A blessing in disguise,
In my opinion. You know, if you'd have said that 2 weeks ago, I would have said you were mad. And to be honest, when I saw the squad announced, I thought...
He's been playing full back, though, isn't he?
He has.
That's the problem.
He's been playing full back. He's undoubtedly a 10 over a full back, particularly at this stage in his career. But that was the first, you know, and he had played. I think he played another game at 10 for Cardiff this season. There had been nothing to suggest that there was the Priestland of old, and then he suddenly rolled this performance out against the Stormers, which was like watching Priestland circa 2011.
Yeah,
and,
but it's the era of the golden oldies, isn't it? Bernard Foley was standing for the Wallabies. You know, Quay Cooper came back before he was injured. He was great. You know, Priestland's back. Yeah, I'd start him. I would start him, and I'd ask him on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you've said there, like, the concern for Anscombe is he's not played. He's hardly played any rugby going into this, and he had to. He started at 10 in this corresponding fixture last year, having not played much rugby either, because it was outside the window, and there was a bit of an injury crisis at 10 as well. He was kind of strong armed into it. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest call that Pivac has to make for his team next week.
Also, yeah. I'd like to see Nicky Smith start as well. He's been the former loose end of Wales.
How many times have we said this? Best scrummager. He's great over the ball. He's a good ball carrier. I mean, he's undoubtedly the best loose head in the country.
Does he pick Ken Owens, a hooker?
No, I think he'll go. I don't think there's a bigger Ryan Elias fan in Wales than Wayne Pivac. He really, really rates him. And again, I think I respect that definitely. You know, we've said it a million times, right? The bit that you always look at with a hooker that stands out is the throwing in. And that's that is a unit thing. It's not always the hooker's fault. I would say that that's the weakest part of his game, I think, because it's not exclusive to Wales. He's had some dodgy outings with the darts for Scarlets as well. He's very good when it comes to scrummaging. I think I think that's what you've got to go with. Ken Owens hasn't played much rugby. I've been so impressed with Bradley Roberts at the Dragons. However, I think for this game, as you said there, right, you are going to be up against a formidable scrummaging unit here. Yeah. You've got to pick your best scrummagers, and that is Nicky Smith, Ryan Elias, Tom Francis.
Totally agree. The other area of contention, if we can sit Tipperick's nailed on, Falter's nailed on, you don't start Arlene Wynne, you start Beard and Rowlands. Who plays six?
Yeah.
Does Rafael play six? Lidgett was outstanding.
He really was.
And Chunza, you know, let's face it, is really in form, and he gives Wales something different. So what do they do at blindside?
If it were me, and obviously everyone can thank the Lord that it's not, I would gamble it on Chunza. I go, let's look to the future here. This guy is a real X Factor player. And he's another line-out option. His athleticism is superb. I think he's a really intelligent player as well. And I think, you know, I think he is going to be a real star for Wales, which is a bit harsh on Lydia. But again, Lydia has been... hasn't strung a huge amount of games together this season. I've no doubt if they pick Lydia, he'd do a brilliant job. So
Rafael at six for me.
Would it? Yeah.
I think you got to win the break, Dunbar.
Yeah, you do.
I think you need him to do that. And I think he's just a dog, isn't he? He's just so destructive in defence. But Lindiot obviously is the best defensive back rower in Wales, but Ref has got that jackpin threat and he slows an opposition ball. So I think he's got to be in a back row.
Question for you, Steph. Is the reason why the breakdown went so well in South Africa down to the balance of that back row as well? And that's kind of, it's a little bit old school, isn't it? It was an old school six, a Jacklin seven, you know, and Faletau being Faletau.
What I would do, I would pick Lindiot, Dreffel and Faletau and Tipperick on a bench, but Tipperick's captain. So, you know, obviously he's going to start. But I agree with you. So, you know, Warburton was as effective as he was. He was a great player, but Lindy had helped him. let's face it. So yeah, I think our back row battle is, you know, is crucial. But I just would like to see Raffel in there. I would like to see him there.
And the rest of the side, do you think that kind of picks itself?
I think so. I think the centre's pretty settled, isn't it? I think that Tompkins has been a constant. He rates him.
On the score sheet again today as well, I think.
Yeah, North 13. And then, you know, the back three, there's some issues there. You know, Josh Adams, touch and go. Louis Rees-Amy is one of the best players in the world, full stop. He's got to be there. You talk about Will Jordan. He's a phenomenal player. But Zamit's in that league for me. He's just sensational, isn't he? So he's got to be there. If he was fit, Adams. You got to play half Ben, haven't you?
I think you do. Yeah,
I think you have to. But there's, you know, he's a doubt as well. It'd be a big gamble to pick Rio Dio, wouldn't it, against the All Blacks?
Yeah, I mean,
you need to ease him into Test rugby.
I think you definitely do. I love watching Rio play. He's brilliant. He's exciting. He plays rugby the way I love to see it played. But he's raw. He's absolutely raw, and you know he's got the opportunity to grow. I would have absolutely loved to see Rio Dyer in a Gatland and Edwards squad. I think he would have learnt so much from, and that's no slight on the current side. I just think that what Gatland and Edwards did so well was with a limited amount of time with players, which is, you know, you get so little time with them at international rugby. I think he was able to, they were able to teach. To teach players things and get them to come away from those camps better players. I think, you know, he's going to be he's going to be eased in. You know, he'll be one for the Georgia and Argentina games, perhaps.
Absolutely. I think it's a team that can cause New Zealand problems, but I'm not sure if it's a team that can beat New Zealand. So, we'll find out next Saturday.
Yeah, and it I know it's something that's said a million times before, but that mentality thing, it just, you know, if the game's 16 all with 5 minutes to go, you do feel that psychological thing of it being New Zealand in front of you would make it a difficult task for Wales. But yeah, it is always exciting when the All Blacks come to town. We'll see how that goes. I'm just going to bother you for a prediction then, Steph. What do you think? What do you think the result will be next week?
Wales 17, New Zealand 30.
Oh, look at that! Not even just a points difference. You've given me the exact score there. Yeah, I was going to say maybe a fraction. No, I think you're probably about right. Yeah, I'm going to go New Zealand by 10. I think but it's perhaps not as close as that. New Zealand by 10, but it never looks like Wales are going to win it. That's what I reckon.
Yeah, I will go with that.
There we go. Look, Steph, been fantastic as always. Thanks very much for joining us again this week. Thank you to everyone for listening. And as always, a thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some quality coffee, you can do that over at socoffeetrades.co.uk. Right, we'll be back to chat rugby with you and to talk all things Autumn Internationals next week. Thanks for listening. Podcast Network.